I'm hoping some of you did your homework. Those of you who are here for the first time, this class requires homework. And the homework of this class is called the Habits of Faith, and that is that we are here to change our habits. How do you change your habits? By new habits. So you need to create new habits in your life. Habits that are tied to our faith, because faith has to come down into our lives, into the actions that we do, because our actions mean a lot to God. And that's exactly what we're going to be learning about today, because that is the whole story about the flood. But before we do that, our homework from last time. So we already have a couple of homework assignments that we've given. One was saying blessings. We gave people got the blessing card. And hopefully you're incorporating that. We also had the homework of saying thank God to, when someone asks you, how are you? Someone said to me before that they have a hard time saying fine. They just say thank God, which is great. Let people draw their own conclusion, and, it means if it's God, then I'm sure it's good, I just don't feel good. Like someone once said, I'm happy, I just don't feel happy. So it's fine, I just don't feel fine. I know it's all good because it's in God's hands, but I don't feel fine. And then last week's homework was, we had a lot of homework, but the main homework that we went home with was the idea of teshuvah, the idea of returning, the idea of that God puts us here on this world so that we make mistakes, so that we trip and fall, and then we rise up again, and we constantly, consistently fall and stand up again. And that's what God wants, and that's part of the way we serve God. And so this week we were supposed to focus on, besides, of course, keeping all those other things going, was to think about something that, recognize something that we've done, that was a mistake that we did, and that we should return, we should change that and go back to that perfect place that we were with God before Adam and Eve actually sinned from the tree. So if anybody would like to share their experience this week, if they have anything to share, Steve?
I don't know if this is exactly what you're meaning, but my 36-year career in the California aerospace industry found me in the habit of looking at things in the worst possible way I could look at them, using Murphy's Law to start with. Anything can go wrong, and it will. So this oftentimes gave me a pat on the back or an attaboy by upper management by finding a design deficiency that could be corrected before it got caused an accident. But unfortunately, I don't know what it was due to my evil inclination or my animal soul, which I didn't really know about in those days. But anyway, this ended up spilling up into my everyday life. Often being accused of looking at things in the saddest, worst, darkest way you can. And I think your commentary here on Genesis has changed my way of thinking of looking on the positive side of things rather than the negative side. I don't know if that's really what you want to do.
That is, if I haven't heard teshuva, that is teshuva. That is real return, because we're supposed to think positive. We're supposed to be positive because it is God's world, ultimately. And so returning, that's exactly returning. The idea of teshuvah is to go back to the way we were before, which was positive. It's beautiful, especially since, in your case, it's been so many years. The more you do something, the more it becomes a habit, the harder it is to break, and therefore the greater the achievement when you actually do break it. So the fact that it's been going on for so long, that's really incredible.
Nah. No, I never complain. I just make factual statements.
I saw a bumper sticker today. Stop global whining.
I love it.
Yes.
Well, I had quite a remarkable experience, and it was actually I had made mistakes, and this friend of mine had made mistakes. But I decided let us begin to think. And really, as we came home from the meeting last week, my husband told me that his friend was going to be operated on for breast cancer. We hadn't seen each other in about 2 years. And remarkably, you know, I didn't do anything because of what you said, but it just fit so incredibly well. I thought about that after. I phoned her the next morning, which was not easy to do, and told her I missed her, and I wanted her to come over for lunch. And she hesitated, but she did come. And she came, and we did not rehash the past. We didn't want to do that. And we talked about what was going on now. And we were able to hug, and for me, I was definitely able to put the past behind and talk about forgiveness and about going on from today. And it was very beautiful. And of course, she's very focused on her surgery now, and she needs to just put all her trust in God, as she said, and that's where her focus is. But she told me she canceled an appointment to come and be with me, and she said yes very quickly, and then sent a letter to the house thanking both of us for being there for her and for trying to.
Beautiful. One mitzvah leads to another mitzvah. One good deed has another one that's followed behind it. That is beautiful. And so the idea is that when we study, it should impact our lives. It should change who we are. And the way it changes us is by little habits. Because you don't change the world one day. You don't change it overnight. Slowly, piece by piece. And that's the way we do it in our own lives. So, great. Keep up the great work. You don't always have to share, but it's always nice when people do share and just show that this is really about the habits and about the changing that goes on inside of us. So we're going to start today on page 31. I know that the reading assignment was chapter 7 and 8, right? But hopefully you read before and you didn't just follow instructions exactly. And so today, we are going to tackle the Great Flood. And what I'm hoping that you've picked up, for those of you who have been coming to the class, and hopefully those of you who are joining us tonight, is that I hope that your perspective on opening this book changes. That these stories are not stories that happened thousands of years ago, that we just read about because they are the foundation upon which we are here today, but rather we should read this as the guidebook to our life. So that when we open the book and we read about Noah, although we're reading something that happened a long time ago, it's actually something that's happening currently as well. And the lessons and the habits that we can learn from Noah are applicable today as they were back then, and as they are in every generation. And so this is a unique way of viewing the Bible, and if you view it that way, great, that is the way it should be, but if it isn't, I would encourage that, hopefully you're getting the idea from coming to this class, that I would encourage you to start viewing the Bible that way, viewing the Torah that way. This is not a book of ancient wisdom, it's actually a current book on life today. And so how is the story of Noah? And we, again, there are a lot of questions about the story, and we can go into a lot of details, but the focus of tonight and all of these classes is what's the message for us, what's the habit that we can extract from these stories. So we're always looking for that angle in these stories. So the first thing is, we kind of got started on this last week, but it starts off telling us about this man, who is the story of the flood really revolves around him. And it starts off as follows, verse 9 on page 31. These are the offspring of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. And so we talked about righteous people. Was Noah really righteous? Was he not really righteous? Someone asked, you know, later on we're going to find out. You know, as soon as he gets out of the ark, he becomes an alcoholic, and you know, he's rolling around naked, and whatever happens. So it's this doesn't sound like a very righteous person. But at the same time, it does say he's a righteous man. So what does that mean? Well, if we take a little closer look at the word, it says, perfect in his generation. What kind of a qualification of his being righteous is that? Noah was a righteous man. Period. End of statement. Why perfect in his generation?
Perfect in his generation for many ungodly who no longer followed God, and Noah was one who was.
So does that make, so your great point, and that was that he lived in a generation that was really bad, which is true. God destroys that entire nation. And so, does perfect in his generation, the fact that the other people were bad, does that make Noah a greater righteous man or a less righteous man? In other words, does that make him better or worse? And it, actually, the Talmud tells us that there's two opinions. One opinion says that perfect in his generations means only in his generation was he perfect. Compared to all the other ones, he was perfect. But had he been in any other generation, he wouldn't have stood out at all. He wasn't really that great. The other explanation is the opposite. That he was so great despite his generation. Had he been in any other generation, he would have shined even greater. So there are two opinions about Noah. And it's very important for us to know this. And that's because there are certain things that Noah does that are unacceptable. They're absolutely unacceptable. And the lesson that we learn from Noah is what not to do. However, he cannot be faulted. It's not his fault. He lived before the flood. And before the flood, it was very difficult to be really righteous. But we live after the flood. We are the product of the flood. We're after the flood. And therefore, we can be better than Noah. So Noah was a flawed, righteous man, but it wasn't his fault. Because something happened during the flood. The flood changed the world. And therefore, anyone who lived before the flood was different than those who lived after the flood. So a lot of the things that Noah does doesn't apply to us. So he did it, it was okay for him to do it. For example, smoking 200 years ago, there was nothing wrong. You were still getting sick. You were still having all the ill and health benefits of smoking. But no one could say that you were doing anything wrong. Hope we're not going to offend anybody here with smoking. I didn't pick her. My grandmother was a chain smoker and outlived my grandfather, who didn't smoke at all, by 36 years. But nevertheless, today we know the hazards of smoking. So today we're wiser about it than we were back then. So you can't fault anybody 200 years ago who was smoking, even 100 years ago who was smoking, even 50 years ago you couldn't fault anybody for smoking. But today, with all of the press, with all of the negativity that's been shown on it, now you got to be really foolish to pick up that habit. So the same thing with Noah. So in Noah's time, the activity that he did, how should he know better? There was no way for him to know better. But today we do know better. So today we cannot act like Noah. Well, what did Noah do that was so terrible? What was so wrong? Well, we're going to learn by reading the narrative here. So what happens? We're going to take a few little detours here as we go through this because there's a lot to the story. And so Noah had begotten three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Jewish people come from Shem. Sem. Semite. We are Semitic. Okay, so we come from Shem. Ham and Yafet. Now, the earth had become corrupt before God, and the earth had become filled with robbery. The Hebrew word for robbery is chamas. Just letting you know that the Hebrew word for robbery is chamas.
Is it the same
kind of word? Not hummus.
Oh, okay. No,
but chamas.
Okay, got it.
Chamas. What exactly does chamas mean? Because the Hebrew word chamas does not appear very often in the Torah. As a matter of fact, the Hebrew word for stealing or robbery is tignov or tigzol, a ganef, a gazlan. Those are Hebrew words for a thief or a robber. The word chamas means also robbery, but it's an unusual word. And that's because it's a unique type of robbery. What type of robbery is this? It's robbery that you could say is not really robbery. It's not black and white robbery. It's not shoplifting. It's not outright fraud. It's worse. It's much more insidious than that. Let me explain. If someone commits a crime that's an obvious crime, that's better than someone who commits a crime that most people don't even think it's a crime. Why? Because crime is black and white. Eventually you'll come to your senses and you will stop the behavior. But a justifiable crime, one that you can, it's so insidious, it's so hard to break that habit. Much more difficult. So if someone actually goes into a store and shoplifts, it's a terrible thing, but there's a worse type of stealing. You know what that is? When you shoplift and you leave the money for it behind. Walk into somebody's house, take their beautiful new big screen TV, take it right off the wall, the $2,000 machine, you leave $2,000 there.
But why do you want to go out? Put the money there instead of going to the store and shop your own.
Hey, I don't know where you got it from. I don't know how to get it. I see it in your house. I want it, but I'm not a thief. I'm not a robber. I'm an honest person.
That's jealousy.
So I bring the money, I put it there, and I take it. You're going to call that a thief?
Jealousy.
I'm not a thief. Jealousy was the sin you committed earlier. When you take it, that's called thievery. The sin you committed before was jealousy.
Yes, you have to want somebody else's property.
Right.
To jealousy.
Right. And again, I just want that TV. You can go get another one, right? There's the money. Taking hotels from, taking towels from hotel rooms. Making a fraudulent claim on an insurance policy. Or it's not completely fraudulent, it's just you're adding a couple of things to it, It's like they came in anyways and, hey, might as well, the carpet also has got to go and, that's bad, it just got to go too, it didn't hurt anybody, right? I mean, insurance companies expect this. It's all part of the... It's just part of the way life is, right? You just make fraudulent claims. We're all paying into it. It's not really stealing. Even better. They're a big company. It's not going to hurt them. I don't steal from people, but big companies, that's not stealing. They're overpricing it anyways. Come on, that's not stealing. The idea that we can justify stealing, that we can justify it, is much more insidious than actually outright thievery. Outright someone walking over to you with a gun and putting you, say, give me your money. That is actually better than someone who is, just taking things and doesn't feel in any way. I mean, listen, the hotels put it in, you know, they pad it into the price. They're expecting you to take the towel. They're expecting you to take the things out of the room. I mean, after all, I'm going to be advertising the hotel. It says Hilton on all of my towels. No, that's just the way, that's the way it should be, right? You know, you just, you go to the restaurant, and when they make you a doggy bag, you put all the salt, the little salt things and sugar, and you put it in your pocketbook, and, you know, and all the extra tea bags, and you throw that in there, and, you know, why not? Exactly. Exactly. The way we were taught, you know.
Rabbi, and we see this all around us all the time, every day.
Right.
So we're doing exactly what they were doing in the time.
There we go. So as soon as you understand that this is what it is, so all of a sudden, these are not these, you know, the corruption of the people before the flood was, they were like us. Oh, that's corrupt. Oh boy, okay. I thought corruption means like, you know, when you go to some third world country and you pay off the police officers. I mean, that's corruption. But here in America, I mean, come on, we're upstanding citizens. We're fine Americans. We're wonderful. And we really are, but we're maybe suffering from a little from us. You know, we may not understand what it is. And then if we go to intellectual property, you know, walking into a bookstore, and this really becomes now this really becomes very 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 very, very challenging. You know, Nordstrom's has a policy you can return anything. You know what I heard about? This was interesting. I was in Nordstrom, and I was talking to the fellow there, and he said, you know how we got our return policy from? When we first started, the first Nordstrom was actually a tire center. And they had taken it over, and they had, and they turned it into a department store. And someone came to return the tires back to the tire store, but it was no longer a tire store. Nordstrom took it back. That's how far their return policy goes. Okay, so they have this. They have a crazy return policy. You can bring something back, even if you wore it, even if you, you know, bought it, wore it to the wedding, and brought it back with the stains on it, with the makeup all over it. They'll take it back. Mm-hmm. They will. They don't ask any questions. They won't make you feel bad. They'll just take it back and issue a credit. No problem. Is that stealing? It's legal stealing. They're letting you. They're encouraging you. They're asking you to do it. Okay. Now, is it stealing or not? I don't know. I'm just raising the issue here that it doesn't smell so clean. It doesn't smell so good. And the same thing with so many other policies that there are that companies have that encourage us to do things that I'm not going to feel bad. It's their policy. They've got a policy that encourages stealing. That's not my problem. That's their problem. Well, they got some kind of a business plan. You know, you walk into Borders Bookstore. You can sit there and read the whole book. Drink some coffee, read the whole book, and leave. And then not only that, they encourage you, right? They have these big, beautiful, comfortable chairs. I mean, they don't put these wooden chairs to make you feel uncomfortable. They got these really comfy chairs that you can sit back and sit there for hours. They don't come over to you and say, excuse me, sir, you've been here for the last 3 weeks, every single day, for 5 hours, you know, we're going to start charging you rent. They don't do that. They love it. They're there. Why? They're selling books. If there's a couple of people who are going to take advantage of the system, it's okay. Let's take it to loss leaders at a supermarket, right? The loss leader, they're selling you that water bottle for 5 cents. You know they're losing money on it. You don't care. All I'm buying is water today. They're losing their money. Is that considered stealing? If I only walk into a store to buy only all the things that are on sale, and I never buy anything else, what is that? And the simple logic is like this. Think to yourself, if everybody did what you are doing, what would happen to this company? They'd fail. So if everybody would do what we're doing is going to cause the company to go into bankruptcy, something's wrong with my behavior. So the fact that only a few people are doing it doesn't make it right for me. I actually started thinking about this with regards to credit cards. once I became a merchant and I actually accept credit cards, I started to understand how credit cards work. You cannot charge more money for credit cards, but it costs the company more money for a credit card. Cost me more money. When you run, someone gives a donation to Chabad, if they give me a check, I get $25 and $25. If they write it on their credit card, I got to pay the credit card company 3%. You go to a store and you buy your groceries, you give them cash or you give them a credit card, they're actually making less money because of you just put it on a credit card. Well, that's what they want. They want me to spend more money. They want me to put it on a credit card. Okay, that's fine. The question is for me. The question is, what am I thinking? I walk into a little store and I buy one little thing for $2, put it on the credit card, times between the fee and the percentage, the guy just lost money on the thing, and it was on sale to begin with. So if we think before we do, and we realize that a lot of the things that we do, that's stealing? I don't know, but it's questionable. It's questionable. I want to live a life that has no chamas in it. I want to live a life that's above, way above board, because this is the corruption upon which the world was destroyed. So God is saying, one thing. Why did I destroy the world? What was so terrible about this? What was so terrible about this activity? You know what's so terrible about it? What's so terrible about it is that when you steal, walk over to somebody with a gun, hold them up, at least you're showing your true colors. Everybody knows you have no fear of man and you have no fear of God. But someone who steals in this way, what are they showing? I fear man, but I have no fear of God. Because the only one who knows that I'm stealing is God. So it's so insidious because everybody thinks you're the most beautiful, most honest person, and you yourself think you're an honest person, except God. So it's really a sin directly against God. And that's why Hamas is really the worst kind of a sin. Because it's so insidious, you don't even realize it's a sin, and you don't even realize who you're really hurting with the sin. Where it's really a sin against God. Same thing with, you know, copyright infringement or, copying things. I mean, it's so acceptable. Everybody does it. And then take it to the cheating in school. You know, the kids cheating in school. Go on and on and on and on and on. There's so many places where we look, and again, it's everybody does it. If everybody does it, then it's an accepted societal activity. But it's stealing. And that's the issue here. So the idea of the flood, that the flood happened as a result of this, really changes the picture for us. Because if we think of them as, oh, they were those horrible, evil people that, you know, you would walk into the streets and you'd be afraid because you'd be pickpocketed and you'd be, murdered or whatever it is. No, that's not necessarily the picture. I'm sure that was also going on. But that's not what got God so angry. What got him so angry was the Hamas. Which is why, of all the things it said, they became corrupt, corrupt, corrupt. The only sin that it mentions is Hamas. Everything else is corrupt. Just use the word corruption. Doesn't identify what the corruption is. And so in our habits of faith, the habits of faith are really what we call personal space habits, which means nobody else knows about it. No one else knows if I am honest or not. There's only one person, one being that knows, and that's God. Only God knows. God knows what's in your heart, and God knows what you're, if you're just, everybody does it, it's okay. God knows. And the truth is, for many of us, we didn't even know. I didn't know certain things. Someone, my accountant does my taxes for me. And I had another accountant who came in to help me out, and he took a look at it. I mentioned something to him, and he said, "You can't do that. That's wrong." You know, I said, "Listen, if you want to do it, you can do it, but I'm telling you it's wrong." And I started arguing with him. I said, "Listen, my other accountant said it's okay," and we got into this whole fight over it. in the end, it turned out that he didn't understand what my accountant did, and it turned out everything is above board. But my first reaction was, wow, this is a big test. Because my accountant seemingly figured out something really nice for me, and now you're telling me that that's illegal? Well, not completely illegal, it's just not proper. And I had this dilemma, what am I going to do? Next year, what am I going to do? Am I going to do the same thing or not? Turned out, everything's above board. Everything is kosher. Everything is okay. But at first, it was like, wow, I didn't know. I simply would not know. There's no way for me to know. And the same thing with these policies and stores. I wouldn't know about credit cards. I wouldn't know about these things. It's not my fault. No one's saying it's anybody's fault. The question is this where we want to go? These are the habits of faith, is to improve in these areas. Because the only one who's going to know is God. You're walking out of the supermarket, the guy forgot to scan the water on the bottom of your basket. Got free water. Or do I go back and say, excuse me, sir, you forgot to scan the water on the bottom. Okay, now water doesn't cost that much money. How about if it's a TV? How about if it's your DVD player? How about if it's something that costs $500, $10,000, it's sitting in there? I don't have to say anything. He won't know. Nobody's going to know. Or do I own up and say, sir, you made a mistake. You forgot to ring me up for this item here.
Isn't that kind of what I believe you were brought this up last week, the IKEA commercial, where the lady's really scooting out of the store fast because she thinks they've undercharged her for stuff, and she's screaming at her husband, turn on the car. Wants to get out.
Exactly, before they catch on.
Yeah, and it was the same thing of the Hamas.
Right. So the idea that it's between you and God. In other words, nobody's going to know. If you walk out of the store, obviously they will find out because they have now with their everything is scanned, and they're going to see. Their inventory is down, and the money is not there. So it got lost somewhere. So it's not like nobody's going to notice. It's just they're not going to know that was you. They're just going to know they got lost somewhere. So it's an anonymous crime. Absolute anonymous crime. And that's what the internet, by the way, has afforded people, allowing people to do anonymous things. Nobody knows who's behind that computer screen, and therefore you feel like you can do whatever you want. But if you believe that God is watching and God knows what's going on inside your heart of hearts, who cares if nobody else in the world knows? God knows. And that's why this is really a habit of faith. Because only if you have faith will you stop the activity. If you don't have faith, there's no reason to stop the activity. Because that's a different set of Ten Commandments. The first of the Ten Commandments, if you don't believe in God, is thou shalt not get caught. That's the first of the Ten Commandments. But if you believe in God, it's not about getting caught. It's about doing what's right for God. Yes?
But you can still have the prayer, and they're so easily anonymous. They're just thinking, and they're very happy. You can't just assume that it's a perfect wrong prayer.
I didn't say anything is a sin. I am just raising the question. I'm simply raising the question. You can do the research on your own, and you can decide you're on your own. It's smelly. You know, it's like a little fishy. When a store, listen, I know what a loss leader is. Right? Loss leader is to get you in the store. That's why they're willing to sell it for a loss. It's called a loss leader. Store is losing money. And it's just a way of getting you in. So instead of spending money on advertising, this is how they do it. So that's their problem. The question is, do I want to be part to it? Do I want to be a party to it? So if I go into a store, for example, you're having a meeting in Starbucks. Do you have to buy anything? You can sit there and have a meeting, right? Do you think it's right that you should sit there for an hour and not buy something?
No.
Seems wrong to me. If you're going to use my facility, you should make a purchase. Now, they don't have that policy. The question is about you. See, it's not about is it stealing, is it not stealing? The question is, how do you feel on the inside? Are you a person who wants to have habits of faith and wants to show, no one has to know that I bought this because I don't want to sit here and not purchase anything. Only God knows. God knows that the reason you bought that coffee, not because you want to drink coffee, but because you happen to have a meeting in Starbucks, in a beautiful place, they're letting you sit there, the least you can do is purchase something for them, and that's how they're going to make their money. Same thing with a loss leader. Yes, I'm going to go to the store, I'm going to fill up on the water bottles, they have them on sale, great. you know what? I'm also going to buy my groceries there. Because that's how the store makes money. They make money off of the other things you're going to buy. So I was going to go to three stores. Instead, I'm going to go to one store. They got the best sales. I'll buy the things on sale. I'll buy the other things there too. That's all. It's a consciousness. It's a consciousness about our honesty and a commitment to God at that question here. So it's not a matter of, well, what's the rule? What's the law? What's the law of the land? The question is, what's inside of you? What's inside the person? Is the person trying to do what's right and wanting to be better? Or is the person trying to get away with things? And so that's really the question. And then you start to think to yourself, you know what? Is it right or wrong to copy music CD? Okay? I'll burn you a copy. Rabbi, I'll burn you a copy of the latest CD that just came out. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I happen to sell CDs. My family, we have our own band, and we sell CDs. I know what it's like when people are burning copies. I just know what it feels like. You know, we spent all this money. We put all this money into it. Is it legal? Is it not legal? Can you take me to jail? Can you not take me to jail? I don't know. It doesn't matter. These people work so hard. Give them the $15. I mean, if we talk about $15 million, okay, I can understand. You know, you want to know all the legal definitions. But $15, I mean, give the $15. That's all I'm saying is, let's start to think about things differently. Whether it's right or wrong, whether it's they're going to punish you in court or not, no. And there may even be legal reasons to say that there is no problem. Intellectual property is not something you can copyright. It doesn't belong to you once you create it. It's out there. And that's a very, very valid argument. The question is, do I want to use that argument? Is that good enough for me? I want to live a better life. I want to live a life of habits of faith. If I'm a faithful person, I believe God provides me with enough money. He's going to provide me. Why do I need to take any shortcuts?
Also, though, you believe that you've got to allow God to convict your own heart. I mean, everybody's got their own conviction of what they believe is sin or what is right or what is wrong. Like what you said about the waters underneath, you know, taking those out, knowing that they're there. Clearly, that's perception. Clearly, you know you should have paid for that. You walked out. To me, that's really easy. But when you say something like, I use my credit card, and I don't make as much money if I use my credit card. Well, you know, that, once again, that's a policy of the store. You know, you're still buying product from them. They're still making money on that purchase you made. So that would be harder for me to go there. Okay.
So let me just clarify it.
Sure.
If I know that I will spend more money in a store if I use my credit card, so it's for the benefit of the store. The benefit of the store, and I'm just going to digress here a little bit, but there's a rule in Judaism that says you're allowed to lie. You're allowed to say a white lie. You're allowed to say a white lie. So, for example, if you go to a wedding, and you're supposed to go over to the bride and tell her how beautiful she is. You're supposed to lie and tell her that she's beautiful, even if she is not beautiful. Yep, you're supposed to lie. You're supposed to go right over and straight lie it and just say, you're so beautiful. That's it. You're just supposed to lie right out. And there's a whole bunch of other things you're supposed to do like that.
You're supposed to do that, actually go up to them?
Yeah. You're supposed to go over to a bride.
It's not like they come up and ask you.
Right, exactly. No, you're supposed to gratuitously offer up that information and lie to a crowd, to a bride on her wedding day and tell her she looks gorgeous. And the answer is she does. Because you're not really lying, it's a white lie. Because what you're really saying is you're beautiful in your husband's eyes. That's what you're saying. Because the husband actually does think she's beautiful. So, but you're not completing the sentence. That's why it's a white lie. It's not a full lie. You're saying you're beautiful in your husband's eyes. So I didn't say the end of that. I didn't fill it in, but it's a white lie. So, like, we'll find it later on with the story. No, you don't say anything. You do not say anything. You don't have to say anything. It's because there's some truth to it, it's called a white lie. It's not a straight lie. Because there is truth to it. We'll find it later on with Jacob and Esau, right? So he's stealing the blessings from his father, and his father asks him, are you Esau? And he says, I am. He doesn't say, I am Esau. He says, I am. It's a lie, but it's a white lie, because he didn't say, I am Esau. He said, I am. I am Yaakov. I am this. He doesn't complete the sentence. I am. It's a white lie. It's not complete. And then he says, Esav, your firstborn. Esav is your firstborn. It doesn't mean that I am Esav. And so he's saying a white lie. So the question is, when are you allowed to say a white lie, when not? And the question that came up was, somebody sent this to me actually in an email, was if you're working in an office and someone calls, is your secretary, and you're standing there, and you just don't want to take the phone call, so you tell your secretary, tell him I'm in a meeting. But you're not in a meeting. Is that, that's lying. But it's a white lie. I mean, it's not, you're just busy, you don't want to take them. Is it okay to say you're in a meeting? And so this is what the rabbi who took this apart to whether or not you're allowed to lie about this, and he came up with this. If you're lying, is for the benefit of the other person, then you're allowed to lie. If it's only for your benefit, you're not allowed to lie. So it depends. If the person who you're lying to is for their benefit, you're allowed to lie. But if it's not for their benefit, you're not allowed to lie. So for example, we have the story of Aaron the high priest. He was known as the peacemaker. What did he do? He would lie. He would go over to two people who were hating each other, and he'd go, you know, I spoke to the other person. He really wants to reconcile, but he's just a little uncomfortable. And he goes to the other person and say, you know, the other person really wants to reconcile, but he's uncomfortable. Oh, really? Oh, the other person wants to reconcile. Oh, that's nice, but he's embarrassed, so I'm his liaison. And he would just say these lies to people, and then they would come back together, only finding out later on that it was Aaron who put them up to it, but that was his way of doing it. So he was lying to them, but for their own benefit, which is fine. However, lying in the case of telling your secretary, I'm in a meeting now, when you're not, who benefits from that? You do. You don't look bad. You know, you look good. That's not kosher. So that's really the question. So the same thing here. So whose benefit is it? Most of the time, for me, I know, I will spend more money on a credit card if I buy it on a credit card than if I spend cash. No one likes to spend cash. You see the money going right, but a credit card, just flip it through, you worry about it later, which is why most of us have credit card bills, because we're spending more money than we have. That's exactly what the companies are all betting on. We're willing to lose the 2.5% because this guy's going to spend way more money if he uses a credit card. So it's in there. It's in the best interest of the store that you use a credit card. But when you walk into a little small mom and pop shop, and you're just buying one little thing, and you have the cash in your pocket, that's when it comes up. But if you have no cash in your pocket, of course they would rather you buy the merchandise than not buy it, because you don't want to make them charge, because you're making this little thing in your head. And so the same thing with the guy walking out with the water bottle, or the water under his cart. You could argue, listen, they have this policy, by the way, in some of the stores. If I make a mistake, if I give you the wrong number on it, this item is free. Right? If I ring it up wrong, the item is free. Huh, you got it wrong. You didn't even ring it up at all. The guy who was supposed to check, it says it on that little paper there, he was supposed to check, he didn't check, the item is free. He rang it up wrong. You can argue so many different things. The question is, so what? So who benefited here? Did the store benefit? Did I benefit? If I benefited, then I should work hard to try to change that. And that's really it. It's not about we're all terrible people, we're all bad people, we're all going to hell because we buy things on a credit card or because we buy things on sale. It's more about just wake up a little bit. It's all about giving us a new perspective. There's room to grow. There's room for us to grow. And the Hebrew word Esav means finished product. Esau. The epitome of evil is finished product. That's evil. Evil is when we think that we're complete, we're done. I am the sign of perfection. Okay, I got to change a little bit here, but mainly I'm okay. Mainly I'm good. God wants us to be under constructionists. We're always under construction, constantly learning more. As we get older, we become wiser. And as we become wiser, we become more observant, more habit-forming in a faithful way. So when we were younger, you tried to talk to us this way, we wouldn't listen. But now we're older and wiser. We appreciate things more. Now that I have children, I appreciate my parents more. Now that I have a business, I understand other businesses more. It's just, I could never understand, I could never appreciate it when I was younger. It's like Noah. It was impossible for him to know of these things, or for these people to know these things. It was before the flood. Right. So the definition of good and the definition of evil. Quickly. The definition of good is anything which is done for God. Definition of evil is the opposite. Anything which is not done for God is evil. So it's a very, very broad definition, but it's very, very clarifying. So when people came to the point where all they thought about was themselves, they could have been a very, very good, upstanding society. But if you remove God from it, then as long as, quote unquote, they let you return it, I'm going to return it. As long as they let me cheat, I'm going to cheat because, hey, there's nothing more. But if I'm doing it for God, I'm going to think about it now. And so that's the difference. When they did everything they did was evil because all they thought about was themselves. They stopped to think about God. And that's the corruption that we're talking about here. The corruption is that all they thought about was themselves. They didn't think about God. And so what is the result of not thinking about God doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's going to be murdering each other and it's going to be total chaos. It could even mean some simple things. As we talked about last week, that Cain and Abel, Cain believed in God. These people believed in God. That was not the sin of this generation. This generation professed a belief in God. But that's not what it's all about. What it's all about is what you do. And so they said, well, God doesn't know. God doesn't pay attention to those things. As long as you're not doing the big things, as long as you're not committing the big crimes, God is happy. And that's what Cain said.
How do we know they weren't creating the big crimes?
They were. I'm sure they were creating the big crimes, but that's not what it says here for all time for us to remember and for us to learn the lesson. It says corruption, and it uses the word chamas. So what's the lesson for us? The lesson is that God was the thing that angered God the most about the flood was not the fact that they did all those other crimes. Those other crimes, unfortunately, happened before, happened after, and continue to happen. It's this that was the most insidious of all, and that's why it's mentioned by name. But not that they didn't do anything else. They did everything else too. But that wasn't what broke the camel's back. That wasn't what took it over the top. What took it over the top was this particular type of sin. And we're going to really encounter this again when we come to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah is very, very, very similar. We always think of Sodom and Gomorrah as this terrible, terrible place. It turns out they weren't terrible at all. They were actually capitalists. That's all they were. It was pure capitalism. You're going to find out when we get to it. Pure capitalism. Pure capitalism is Sodom and Gomorrah. It was not anything different than pure capitalism. And thank God we don't live in pure capitalism. We have capitalism, but it's very much tempered with the Judeo-Christian value system, which changes the capitalism to a healthy, mature, and good capitalism versus pure capitalism, which is what was Sodom and Gomorrah. But we'll get to that a different time. Nothing has changed.
What is beyond capitalism?
Oh, no, capitalism is all about that. It's not pure capitalism is go to Las Vegas. That's pure capitalism. There's no as long as it doesn't hurt anybody, not hurting anybody, no, it's fine.
Yeah, Hamas, really I think why it's so over the top is that you don't believe anything is wrong. You have no moral compass. There's no black and white, like you said, that gray. And when you live in a life of gray, you really are in trouble. Because you'll allow anything, anytime, any place, and can justify it in yourself.
And you'll never change.
Exactly. And you don't expect anybody else to do otherwise.
Yeah, when you think it's okay, that's the worst. Because if you know it's wrong, even though you're doing it, eventually you'll get over it. I remember this, growing up, I remember this, a couple of things that stand out. When I was growing up, I remember I was a little kid, And I'm embarrassed to say this, but I think it's good for just to clarify this. I was a little kid, and I turned I figured out in a brilliant way how the health program that we were with allowed you to get a free pair of glasses once a year. I needed glasses as a little kid, and I was always breaking them and always needed repairs, and I was like, you know, we could go to a different one that doesn't know us, and we can get another pair for free. And I thought this was the most brilliant idea, because we can go to different, you know, we just get a whole bunch of free pairs. And I brought up the idea to my dad, and my dad said, he turned around, I remember, and he said, why would you want to steal? I was like, steal? But it's the policy. The policy is you get a free pair of glasses. He says, yeah, but they only want you to get one a year. If you're going to go to another place where they don't know, you're taking advantage of them, and of course they will give it to you, but that's called stealing. And that was like, whew, a brick in the head if I was a little kid, and it made a tremendous impression upon me that, ooh, that's stealing. It's stealing. Not, he didn't call it anything else, he just said it's stealing. And stealing, I knew it was wrong, but this I thought wasn't wrong because they let you do it. I mean, it's almost like they're allowing you to do it. Another thing was that my parents allowed us to do certain things outside the home, but they wouldn't allow us to do it in the home. One of them was watching television. We had no television in our home. But yeah, my parents knew that we'd go over to our friend's house, and we were going there officially to play ball, but of course what we would do, we would sit inside and watch TV. Because we didn't have a TV, and TV was like, it's got to be the you know, the greatest thing. The other kids could bear, you know, they had the TV all the time, they didn't want to watch it. But we were like, didn't have any TV. And I always thought to myself, you know, my parents knew. I mean, they weren't, you know, we'd come back, our eyes were like glazed like this. So what were you doing there? Oh, we were playing ball. They knew exactly what was going on. They weren't foolish. But it was very, very clear to them. They said, it's okay. And they were happy that we were doing it because they don't want us to grow up. If you have this desire for something and you keep it bottled up, you know, what happens, you can go crazy and lose it all. So this was our outlet, but at the same time, we knew very clearly that this was not for our standards. And at home, it was clear this was not for us. So therefore, we would grow out of it. We would actually grow out of it. And so it's the idea that once we know that something is wrong, we'll grow out of it. But if no one ever tells you there's something wrong with it, you'll never grow out of it. You'll always think it's okay, and you'll actually think that you're the greatest person in the world. Because look how smart I am. I'm able to get more with my dollar than you. Oh, but you didn't realize that you're not really getting more. You think you're getting more. You're actually cheating somebody else on the other end.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, which is, again, something that will come up in the prophets. All the prophets came to the Jewish people telling them, you know, the temple's going to be destroyed, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, and what do they say? Kill the prophet. He's bad. How dare you say about us that we're bad people? It's so difficult for us to look at ourselves and to see that. And that's because many times, the quote-unquote sins that we do, we so justify them, we don't think of them as sins. So if somebody confronts you and says you're sinning because I saw you break into the store, yeah, you're right, sorry, I'm so sorry, you caught me, because everybody knows it's wrong. But when somebody confronts you on something much smaller, which is seemingly justifiable, and someone says that's wrong, you go, this guy's a fanatic. This guy's he's crazy. I mean, everybody does it, it's okay, and there's nothing to be, nothing to be embarrassed of. So it's exactly... that's really the problem, is that it's not so black and white wrong. So if we get back here to the story here, so God says to Noah, and God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupted, in verse 12, and for all flesh had corrupted its way upon the earth. And here we have interesting that not only did the humans corrupt their ways, but also the animals corrupted their ways, which is very interesting, that human activity has an effect on the animal and plant world. something very interesting, that our actions actually affect negatively and positively the world around us. So we are told that as the generations descended or degenerated, so did the quality of the produce. Quality of the produce, it says, if you were back in the times of, you know, going all the way back, the food was so full of nutrition, it was so luscious, it was so full of taste, and the taste was lost. It was lost because of the sins, because the world is a reflection of us. The good news is, it doesn't happen anymore. That's the good news. The good news is that the world no longer is a reflection of our actions. It's not because we're so great, it's because we're so lost. We're so far from where we should be that it doesn't have that effect. Not because we're bad people, but because of the generations, the way it's gone. So in the early generations, because they were so prominent, what they did mattered so much. Our generation, because we're a product of all of this degeneration, what we do doesn't affect the world, which is why we're seeing today that actually we're able with technology to actually bring things back. We're actually starting to restore life. We're living longer. We're living healthier. Food is going to get better. All these things are changing. Why? Because we're no longer tied to it. Because we're bringing it back. We're the ones who are turning it back the other way. We're bringing the world back to the way it was in the times of the Garden of Eden. Okay. So, not only did the people corrupt, but the animals did too, which is why the animals will die in the flood as well. Had they done nothing wrong, they would not have died. Okay, verse 13, God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with robbery." Again, using the word robbery, "through them, and behold, I am about to destroy them from the earth." Then God says, "Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make the ark with compartments and cover it inside and out with pitch." This is how you should make it. He gives them the exact dimensions. It's a giant, giant ship. 300 cubits in length, 50 cubits in height and width, and 30 cubits in height. A window shall you make, etc. And verse 17. "And as for me, behold, I am about to bring the floodwaters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which there is a breath of life from under the heavens. Everything that is in the earth shall expire." Something so interesting. God tells him to build the ark, and then he tells him he's going to bring a flood. Wouldn't you think you should tell him the other way?
Yeah.
First tell him he's going to bring a flood, and then build the ark. Well, it's interesting because it actually says that it took Noah 120 years to build the ark. And the question is asked, what was he taking so long? God says, build the ark. Well, you take your time and do 120, take 120 years to build the ark? And the answer is that Noah built the ark himself. Nobody helped him. And if you think about how big of an ark he built, it's a miracle that he was able to build it in 120 years. It's a giant, giant ship, and it was seaworthy. So what God was telling him was, I want you to build the ark because I want you to build it. Not the result that I want an ark built. Which is why God tells it to him first. He says, first build an ark. Because I want you to build an ark. Forget about why I want you to build an ark. I want you to build the ark because I want you to do it, and I want you to do every bit of it for 120 years. What was the purpose? Why did God want him to build it? So that people would see. For 120 years, they would see an ark being built, and it would give them a chance, 120 years, to repent. Because everybody saw, where did Noah build his ark? Where? Yeah, he didn't build it on a waterfront. He didn't build it in a shipyard, right? He built it in the middle of a city. When in the world are you building a boat in the middle of a city? You'll never be able to get it to sea. How are you going to get it to the ocean to use it? So he told him, the water's coming to us. This boat is going to float when the waters come. Then I'm going to get inside the boat and then I'm going to take off with my family. You guys are all going to die. So he told them for 120 years. God wanted them to hear this for 120 years and give them a chance. Because God didn't want to just destroy the people. He wanted to give them a chance. Just like when God comes to Adam and says, where are you? He wants to give him a chance to say, I sinned. Instead, he says, doesn't answer. Or he says, Or same thing with Cain and Abel. Right? God says, where is your brother Abel? What was God asking him? God was giving him a chance. God wants to give him a chance to say, I did it, I committed the murder, and own up to it. So God was giving the people a chance to own up to it and say, yes, we've sinned, yes, we've done something wrong, this is not the way to live, and rehabilitate themselves. But they did not. Now, why is Noah not so righteous? Because Noah did not pray for his people. He didn't pray for his people. He just let them know. He just told them, hey guys, if you don't repent, you're all going to die. And they said, you know what? Not only are we going to die, you're coming with us. When that flood comes, we're going to break your ark. That's what the people told him. They didn't appreciate his message. But he did what he had to do. God told him to tell everybody that he's coming. And he did it. He really didn't care about people. He cared about getting what God had told him to do. So he said the words that God told him to say. But that's not what God wanted. God wanted him to take what he said and to do it properly. Right? So you're a teacher in school, or you're a parent, or you're a spouse, or whatever life, you know. Hey, I did my job. I did my job. I told the kids they should clean up. I told them they should do it. I told the kids to prepare for the test. I did my job. I told the principal. I did my job. I told my spouse, yeah, I did exactly what you said. Is it about what I said, or is it the spirit? Is there something behind it? And so God tells Noah, I'm going to destroy these people. What, you don't care about them? I'm telling you to tell them to repent because I care about them. Noah, why don't you care about them? Why don't you do something for them? You're the leader of the generation. You're the tzaddik of the generation. You're the righteous man. Why don't you pray for them? He had no empathy. He just did his job. And that's why he's not a good tzaddik. He's not really righteous. And that's why we'll find Abraham comes along, and when the people of Sodom and Gomorrah are about to be destroyed, what does he do? He prays for them. Who's he praying for? A bunch of sinners. A bunch of corrupt people. That's who he's praying for. Why? Because he learned a lesson from Noah. He heard about Noah, and he heard that God was not happy with Noah because Noah didn't pray for the people. So Abraham said, oh, I got to pray for the people. But ultimately, you know what happened? Even Abraham didn't reach the highest, right? Because when God said there's no hope, he went home, right? When God said there's nothing you can do, he said, okay, I tried. I prayed for them, and there's nothing I can do. But what did Moses do? Moses said, you forgive those people or else erase me from your book. So Moses says, if you won't forgive these people, take me out of your book. I'm done. Out. I'm dying with my people. Abraham didn't go to Sodom and Gomorrah and say, God, if you can't save those people, I'm going and dying with them too. Abraham was not on that level yet. And again, we can't fault Noah. We can't fault Abraham. We can't fault any of them. Based on the time that they lived, that was all they could achieve. That's as high as they could reach. And with this, we're going to get to kind of a very, very deep understanding of what the purpose of this flood was. So what does God do? God brings a flood for 40 days and 40 nights and just wipes out every single living thing on earth. There are a lot of questions about this, and I don't want to get into it, as to was it everyone on earth, or was it just that area? That's a whole separate discussion for a different time. That's more philosophical. But why? Why would God destroy everyone? And number two, as soon as God is done destroying the world, what does he say? I'm never, ever going to do that again. Why not? Why wouldn't you do it again? If there was a good reason to do it the first time, then do it again. If there wasn't a good reason to do it the first time, then don't do it the first time. He said, I'll never bring a flood again. I will never destroy the world again.
With water. By water.
Period. No, not even without water. He wouldn't destroy the world again. God would never destroy the world again. No way. He puts a sign in the sky. Right? What's the sign that God uses in the sky?
The rainbow.
The rainbow. Why the rainbow? Why a rainbow? Huh? After a bad rain?
It's a promise.
Yeah, but why a rainbow? Why did God choose a rainbow of all things? So let me teach you a deep Hasidic insight, or a mystical insight. And that is that the flood, the purpose of the flood was twofold. Number one, it was to wipe out all those who had gone so far that there was no way they could return. They couldn't do teshuva anymore. There was no teshuva left. They could not return. They had gone too far. They went where no one can return from. They reached a point of no return. So God had no choice, because there was now no usefulness for these people, no purpose left in them, because they could not return. As long as someone can return, then there's purpose, there's usefulness in them. Once you can no longer return, you are useless. You can't serve any purpose anymore. The whole purpose of falling and making a mistake is that you should come back. If you can't come back anymore, that's it, it's over. So that was one level. But there was another purpose to this, and that was, why did people reach a place of no return? How was it possible that God's creation, God's handiwork, that started with Adam, could end up in a place that was so bad that these people had reached a place of no return? How was it possible they could reach there? And the answer was, the world had too much covering of God, of God's light. The world was a little bit too dark. The light of God was not shining through properly. As we mentioned, I don't know if it was two times ago, or about the names of God, right? So there's one name of God which is the light, and there's another name of God which is the filter. The filter was too strong. When the filter is too strong, it's possible for people to reach a point of no return. God said, I got to change it. I must change this. The balance is off. The lighting is off. I got to change the lighting of the world. I must allow more of my light to shine through so that this will never happen again, so that people will never reach this place. How am I going to do that? I need to purify the world. Purifying the world means it's less dense. The density of the world is less, and therefore God's light shines through more. Now I'll add one little thing to this. What's a rainbow? A rainbow is light. Correct. Before the flood, the clouds were too thick. The clouds were too thick to allow a rainbow to shine through. Now that God had brought the flood, everything became lighter. It wasn't so dense anymore. So the rainbow is actually the indication that the world has changed. That the world is no longer dense as it used to be. The light can shine through, and that's why we can see a rainbow. So the rainbow is not just a simple sign that God said, you know, I'll make a rainbow. No. Rainbow is a scientific thing that happens when the balance is right. When there's just enough water and just enough light, then you have a rainbow. If the water is too thick, if the light is not strong enough, you don't have a rainbow. So a rainbow is the perfect symbol and sign. There's also another thing. Up until now, they were not allowed to eat meat. All of a sudden, they're given permission to eat meat. Why? because now they weren't so dense. Before, they were too dense. The animal was too dense and the people were too dense to be able to extract any light that there was in the animal. Now they're instructed they can kill the animal because now it will not lead them to a dark place. Before, had they done it, it would have made, they would have become cruel and mean to animals. They could kill them for food. But now they had been elevated. The idea of a 40 days, the Jewish ritual bath, has 40 sa'ah in it. Sa'ah is a measurement, a gallon. But it has a lot more than 40 gallons. A sa'ah is a large measurement. And a mikvah is made up of 40 sa'ah. And so God basically takes the world and puts it in a virtual mikvah. He puts it into a ritual bath. What is the purpose of putting it into the ritual bath? The purpose is elevate the world. So Noah, it was not possible for Noah to truly empathize with other people. Why? The filter was too thick. The filter was too thick. To be able to empathize with another person, to truly feel another person, means that you elevate the soul above the body. You need to elevate. They couldn't. They were still under the influence of that strong filter that God had created the world with. And therefore the light could not shine through, and therefore they could not appreciate the soul of one another. After the flood, started to get a little lighter. It started to get a little brighter. Now it was possible for Abraham to pray for his people, to pray even for Sodom and Gomorrah. When the Torah would be given, that would be another breakthrough, another shattering of the filter, another breakthrough of the filter, and therefore even more light would start shining through, which is why Moses would be able to not only empathize with people, but actually sacrifice himself for the people. And so this is the story of the flood. The flood has given us today the ability to be able to live a more godly life, to be able to be more in tune with the godliness that's around us. So the filter was thick, but God burst the filter. He busted it at the flood. He would destroy it again or lower the intensity of the filter with the giving of the Torah. And through our work that we have been working all of these years and continuing to work, where that filter is almost completely gone. And it's just that last push, finally breaking off the last filter, that's going to be the great coming of Mashiach. The whole idea of the Messiah is when the filter is gone. When the filter is gone. And with this, I want to tie in something very interesting. And that is that if we look in verse 11 on page 35. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened. And so the Zohar, Jewish book of mysticism, says that in the year 5600, the same thing is going to happen. The windows of the heavens will open, and the fountains of the great deep will burst forth. But this time it's not going to be water, it's going to be intelligence. It's going to be information. is going to burst forth in the year 5,600. What year is 5,600? It's 1840. What happened in 1840? The Great Industrial Revolution. And what was going on in the Jewish world? That was the great discovery of the Hasidic movement, which was a bonfire of spiritual literature that was really revealed in an unprecedented way like never before. And so the question is asked, we can understand why it says that the heavens, by the windows of the heavens will open, because this is a prelude to the coming of the Messiah. And the coming of the Messiah is going to be a great burst of spiritual energy. But why would there be at the same time a great burst from the fountains of the deep? That's science. It's the Industrial Revolution. I mean, what would one have to do with the other? Why would they be linked in any way? And so the Rebbe, everything I say, by the way, pretty much without having to say this, comes from the Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson, but the Rebbe explains and says that the connection is as follows. The whole idea of the flood was that God was taking off the filter, lessening the filter. When you take off the filter, then you start to see how the physical world is actually part of godliness. What happened through the Industrial Revolution? As although at first it seemed that it actually was contradicting to religion, that all of this scientific discovery was actually in some way contradictory to the Torah, it turns out that not only is it not contradictory, it's actually so complementative. They complement each other so well. For example, we have a statement in the Talmud that says that if you contemplate about three things, you will never come to sin. What are those three things? If you think about the fact that there is an eye that sees, an ear that hears, and everything that you do is recorded in a book. So, in ancient days, that idea was, you really had to leave it up to absolute faith. But today, you can go on your computer, and you can actually see across the world. There's a little camera, a webcam, that is set up, and you can actually watch what goes on at the Western Wall, at the Kotel, 24 hours a day. This is a webcam. You can actually stay, and it moves, it goes back and forth. You can actually see what's going on at the Western Wall 24 hours a day. If you go on Google Earth, you can literally see anywhere. I mean, those are old pictures. But we have the technology today with satellites and with GPS and with other things recording everything you do. Every time you type on a computer, it's recorded. Mm-hmm. There's a cookie created, right? Everything is recorded. The idea that there's some kind of mega computer that could really literally have an imprint of every single action we've ever done in our life is now no longer science fiction. It's actually, Star Trek has now become reality, much better than Star Trek. We've got it. It's unbelievable. And so what happens is the actual scientific discoveries are actually clarifying our quest for spirituality. With the understanding of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, we really start to understand about God. We really start to see unbelievable things. So it's not just that the windows of the heavens were open or will open in 1840, but actually the fountains of the great deep, the idea of science, the idea of the secular knowledge would actually be the same thing. And that's because the filter is now even less and less. That now we don't have to only go to the Torah to find the light. You can actually go to science and become religious. If you study it properly, beware. Science can make you religious. It's something that nobody ever thought would happen. And that's because of the effects of the flood. The effects of the flood are, it started this process of purification of the world, that the filter is now being taken away. So we could be sitting here in 2008, and we could be thinking about how we could improve our lives, that although we live such honest and good lives, we can actually think about that maybe we could even improve on that. That we could live an even higher level of life. That we could actually be more careful and more in tune and more intentional about the way we treat other people's money. This is an amazing thing. That we could sit here, we're just ordinary people, we're not great, righteous, amazing people, we're just regular people. And yet we are contemplating great things. Because greatness is no longer reserved for the great. Greatness has now become commonplace and ordinary. Because as that filter is being taken away, the light of God comes through, and now the extraordinary now becomes commonplace. And it's possible for each one of us to be extraordinary. You don't have to be an extraordinary person to be extraordinary. You have to be extraordinary when the filter is on very, very hard and very heavy. But when the filter is lessened, and goodness becomes a way of life. Recently there was a Jewish, I want to say a congressman, I don't want to say, not sure. He was running for a seat in the Carolinas, in the South. Jewish guy in a majority black constituency. His opponent, who was black, went on a smear campaign against him, insinuating some very anti-Semitic statements. That he only cares about his type and what's he doing here anyways, and doesn't really represent the black community. I mean, a real smear campaign. This guy, the Jewish guy, got 79% of the vote. Not only didn't it help this fellow, it actually helped the Jewish guy get elected by this guy coming out against him and using this anti-Semitic stuff, which we would all think should work. It didn't. Why? Well, you can come up with your own explanations, but if we want to go along this thread here, the filter. As the filter gets less and less, the extraordinary becomes more commonplace. Doesn't mean that everybody is extraordinary. It doesn't mean that everybody's good. We still have a long way to go. But the light is starting to filter through. And so the habit that we're going to try for this week is the habit of being even more honest and even more careful, because we all are, and this is not, I hope nobody took it the wrong way. We're not thieves. We're not robbers. We are not engaged in illegal activity. But we all can improve. There's no end to our improvement. And the only way we can improve is if we can really look at ourselves and say, you know what, I could be better. And the fact that somebody else is doing it and the fact that everybody else is doing it only makes it that much more difficult for me to truly see what the right thing to do is. But ultimately, there is a right thing to do. And I can live a more righteous life, and I can start a new habit. And that habit is to be more conscious of other people's money. And that if it's in their benefit, I will buy the loss leader. If it's not in their benefit, I won't. If it's in their benefit that I make the return, for example, my grandfather, God bless his soul, never returned anything. That was his policy. He bought something and never returned it. He thought it was absolutely wrong to return anything to a store. He lived on a very, very high spiritual level. I mean, in Jewish law, by the way, there is such a thing that you should not go window shopping. Because window shopping, especially when the shop owner is in the store, it gives him the impression that you actually want to buy. And then you're really not interested in buying. You're just window shopping. So really finding out, first, that's a very, very high level. Most people don't live on that level, but I just wanted to throw it out there. So my grandfather, not only wouldn't he go shopping because of that, if he ever did go shopping, he never returned anything. Because when the person sells the product, they're not expecting it to come back. Although in your business plan, you make room for returns and you figure into your, but when you sell it, you're hoping it's not coming back. And he didn't want to return it. Even if he bought the wrong thing, if there's something wrong with it, it didn't matter. He refused to return it. Now, that's a very good for him, and if we could all live up to that, that would be great too. However, I feel that if I bought something in a store and I felt it was defective, I bought a pair of shoes, it was supposed to last me for 6 months, it lasted for two, if I'm not going to return it to the store, or they have a bad return policy, I am never going to shop in that store again. So who benefited here? They didn't get those one shoe brought back, but as a result of that, they lost my business. I think they would rather take back that pair of shoes and keep me as a customer than I be so holy and keep the pair of shoes. So don't try to be, hurting the store. You have to think about who am I hurting ultimately? If I'm hurting them, then obviously that's not good. But to think about these things, and just to think about it and to try to become better. Yeah, it's hard when somebody comes over to you and offers you a whole slew of things that were just copied, and it's very hard to say, I don't really take things that are, that are not licensed, or I'd like to pay for the license or whatever it is. It's hard. It's so easy, I'll load it up on your computer. I'll just do it for you. What are you going to say? No. I mean, it may not even be illegal. I don't know. I have to talk to my lawyer first. Okay, so that might be very difficult. But little by little, less and less and less, till it becomes something that we're literally uncomfortable with. It's really, really amazing. It really is amazing. I was thinking about it on the way here. How the soul of man, so sensitive, and how we can corrupt not our soul, but ourselves, because when we're born, we're kind of living a kind of a soulful life, very, very full of soul. But when we introduce violence, vulgarity, or other things like that, the soul is actually going down. The soul's influence on us goes down. And the same thing happens with all of these questionable activities that we do. It affects the soul. It affects who we are. And it's amazing how when we undo it, how soulful we become. How much more our life is actually, we live a much higher life. And so we're going to start this week on focusing on being more honest and trying to be a better person in that area. If anybody has any questions, I'll take them at this time.
I have two questions. One, I'm glad you're opening my eyes and ears. Certain things I wasn't sure I was going to know, but it seems that it's unfair. If I am persecuting, I am making a sin. I wasn't aware of it.
I didn't say it's a sin. Please don't quote me on this. It's not a sin to buy something on sale. It's not a sin.
Or if a secretary is lying for the boss that he's there and he says, tell the client that I am not here. So I am making a sin for him, or I'm making a sin for myself.
Ah. So should you listen to your boss when he tells you to lie on your behalf? So just say, is it okay, boss, if I would say that you're not available? That's it. I'm just going to say, is that okay if I say you're not available? I'm just always going to say you're not available. Just say, it's clean. I didn't say you're busy. I didn't say you're in a meeting. I didn't say you're not here. I just say you're not available. That's it. I will always say you're not available all the time.
One more question. Last week, unfortunately, I was in town, but I was reading the Cain and Abel, both they had offering for God, but I didn't quite understand why Abel was acceptable, but not the brother Cain. and what happened, can you help me understand that part?
I'm going to have to defer that question to after the class, since it's not the topic tonight. Yes.
You said there were three things that the Talmud said, and I only got the eye that sees and the ear that heard.
Everything you do is written in a book.
Talking about this taking off the filter, it made me think of the little Chinese boy that they had at the beginning of the opening ceremony in Beijing.
The little boy?
Mm-hmm. He's 8 years old, and the reason he was in this, he was a survivor in the earthquake, and he, 22 of his classmates were killed, and a class of about 30-some kids, and he went back into that rubble after he climbed out and saved three of his classmates, and himself in danger. And they said, why did you do this? And he said, well, I'm one of the class leaders, and it was my job. And he's only 8 years old, yet he saved three people. And I thought that was really incredible. This child had such an understanding of the value of life and saving others.
That's beautiful. Last question. We have a last question. Yes.
The word earth is used so many times in the Hebrew. And the Hebrew word earth, and that's different from Eretz, you see the land of Israel, Eretz Israel. Is there some oral tradition that idiomatically defines that Eretz as the earth, the whole earth, as opposed to
civic land?
Yes, it's a specific area.
It doesn't say the whole earth, it just says earth, meaning
meaning
the ground. It doesn't say how big.
Planet.
Right. I mean, there is a big question as to whether or not Israel was affected by the flood. It's a big question whether Israel was affected by the flood. Because it says that he opened up the window, right, and he sends out the birds, and the birds come back with an olive.
Right.
Where did the olive branch come from?
Yeah.
So something grew so fast. In other words, if all trees had been wiped out, how could he find an olive branch? And if he did find an olive branch, how was that an indication that the earth had dried? Mm-hmm. Right, that was why he sent out the birds, to find that if the earth had dried. How would that... So these are big questions that are just there for you to think about.
I always wondered.
Right, and were the fish affected by the flood? Did the fish die or not? The tradition is that the fish were not affected by it, but yet the water was so hot. How did they survive? A lot of very interesting questions that come up. What about the fish? Well, good night, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. We'll see you next week, God willing. Thank you. Thank you.